Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you, of course, by globalresearch.ca. And I'm delighted to have back on the program Michael Mandel. Michael is a professor of law at Osgoode Hall Law School at York University in Toronto. He teaches international criminal law, constitutional law, and legal politics. I hope we can get to two issues in the hour. One of them is a book that was published in 2004 that's every bit as relevant now and will be for many years to come. And oh, it has an inspired title. I love it when I decide I want to write on something and I come up with a title that I say, oh my goodness, I just have to write something to go with that title. This title is one of those. It's called How America Gets Away with Murder. Subtitle, Illegal Wars, Collateral Damage, and Crimes Against Humanity. Maybe we can start off the program with a paper that Michael will be presenting at York University. He mentioned in an email to me that he's already coming under attack for even mentioning the possibility of a one-state solution for Palestine, but he is addressing international law issues regarding either a one-state or a two-state solution for Palestine. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, Steve. It's a pleasure to be back.
Oh, it's terrific having you back. You remember the drill we go through. Music means a commercial coming, and
right.
We'll take it. I'll interrupt. We'll take the commercial and come on back. But I have some very strong feelings about a one-state, a two-state solution,
mm-hmm.
and a lot more, and I know you do, too, because you've written on occupied Palestine before and issues of law, certainly regarding Canadian law. But maybe you can talk a little bit about that paper, and we can get into that. We've got, a minute or two before the first break.
For sure. Listen, you know, when you said I was coming under attack, I think it's important. This conference is meant to explore it's called Mapping Models, Visions of States for Palestine. It's got, and Israel, it's got scholars from all over the political spectrum, and it was originally called One State or Two because there's this debate going on. And the interesting thing about it is, of course, I mean, it's an academic subject of great urgency, great importance, great debate. But the pressure that the university has come under to cancel this conference is just unbelievable. From the United Jewish Appeal to the Jewish Defense League, I mean, the Jewish Defense League, it's surprising it's even allowed to operate in Canada. Its symbol is the Kach Party symbol, Meir Kahane, which is banned as racist and terrorist in Israel and in Canada. But anyway, they're threatening the university with all sorts of actions if they even discuss this. And it's quite incredible. The people who scream bloody murder over an academic boycott are willing to use any means whatever to prevent anything like this from being discussed. So we know that even the discussion of it is a big threat to the extremist supporters of the government of Israel.
When is the conference scheduled to take place, Michael?
June 22nd to 24th.
So they can throw a lot of flack at you between now and then, and they indeed can apply pressure. They could do it anywhere in the world.
It's unbelievable. It's fascist, but it really is ironic from the people who say, you know, when we have the union saying we should boycott Israel for crimes against humanity, they want to boycott universities for discussing crimes against humanity. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. Anyway, my paper is on the international law questions. It's really an interesting issue because, of course, international law is invoked in this. All sides say that they observe international law. But the international law is quite clearly against what Israel has been doing for at least 40 years, maybe for 60 years. That's the one-state or two-state question. And the failure of international law to do anything about this, or the failure of the institutions,
let me interrupt. They're going to break away. Let's take a break. And
let's break
right
on this
back.
Beautiful music of yours.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Michael Mandel, talking about his paper on a one- or two-state solution for Palestine. Michael, talking about occupied Palestine is a core issue on this program. I only know of one other in the U.S. I don't know what happens in Canada or other countries, but I do know that criticizing Israel is a very risky proposition most anywhere, and it's astonishing and shocking that a country the size of Israel, population-wise, about the equivalent of the city of Chicago, wields that much international power. It literally has the U.S. Congress and administration going back decades in its pocket. You mentioned 40 years. I think especially in the last 40 years since the 67 war, when the U.S. was getting beaten up pretty badly in Vietnam, and Israel just rolled over Arab states. And it wasn't attacked. It was a war of aggression by Israel. But the so-called Six-Day War, it just rolled over the opposition. And they didn't do as well in 1973, but back then. And Lyndon Johnson, I think at that point, just made a decision that whatever we've been doing up to now, we need to do more of it. But I guess it began back with Harry. Well, it began way, way back with the British, Michael, 1917 Balfour. But Harry Truman pretty much sealed the fate of the Palestinians going forward with the unconditional recognition of Israel seconds after the state of Israel was declared a state.
Well, it was great strategic importance to them. I'm not, you know, I don't pretend to understand what it is that makes the United States back Israel so strongly, so completely. I tend to agree with Chomsky that it's more United States strategic interests and than it is some kind of power that Israel holds over them. Because I think that, you know, Herzl tried to sell this to England as a loyal little Ulster in the Middle East. When they became, you know, when the Middle East, around the Second World War, people realized the oil riches and the strategic importance of it, it became very important to have a very loyal ally there, a military outpost. And I think that if Israel strategically became necessary to the West in the Middle East, I don't think it would hold the power that it seems to hold. I think that's the great fear in Israel now, is that somehow Israel is losing its strategic importance to the West, and it knows very well that it depends. I mean, a country, you know, there's 7 million people, 5 million Jews with that kind of military hardware, it doesn't have the production for that. It gets it all from outside. And consequently, this has always been the way Israel has sold itself. And, you know, it's questionable whether, in my mind, an Israel at peace, you know, with its neighbors in the Middle East would be of any value at all to the West. And consequently, whether, you know, Israel realizes that unless it's at war, it serves no value to the West, and then it can't survive. Otherwise, it just becomes a Middle Eastern country. And can't justify its standard of living and all those sorts of things. So it's an open question to me whether Israel, you know, whether Israel as it sees itself, as it exists, a very rich country of the third world, could survive as such at peace with its neighbors at all.
Well, there is a lot of truth in what you just said. And Israel made that decision going back to the 1940s at least. Under its Zionist ideology, there really wasn't two camps, one favoring a more benevolent approach, getting along with its Arab neighbors, and the other side, which won out, taking a hostile approach and deciding that it needed to present itself and prepare itself to present itself as a violent state to scare its Arab neighbors into not wanting to mess with this Jewish existence.
And
because
I think,
if you
that's
get
been the history of it. I mean, it's a history of constant warfare, which is you know, a great tragedy for everybody involved. But anyway, you know, I'm not a political scientist. I'm not a sociologist. I'm not a historian. I'm a lawyer. So I'm trying to examine the legal side of this question. And, you know, the one thing is very, very clear. There's a case, you know, in the World Court in 2004 on the separation wall, the apartheid, so-called apartheid wall. They call it the separation wall. The General Assembly asked the World Court for its opinion on it that was being built. It is being built. It is basically in the same place. And it was an extraordinary decision by the World Court. Everybody, you know, Israel and its supporters were trying to boycott it, discredit it, just like they're trying to do every discussion of this. But the World Court made a decision which was extraordinary, to hold essentially that the occupation since 1967, every settlement there was illegal. Not only the wall, but the settlements, because the wall was supposed to protect the settlements. So they said, you know, what about these settlements themselves? They said they're a huge war crime, violation of Geneva Conventions. You have no right to colonize a country that you say you occupy for self-defense. Now, the court was unanimous on this. I mean, it's quite incredible. Even the American judge, by the way, a guy named Bergenthal, is a German-Jewish Holocaust survivor. There were two Jewish judges on this court out of 15, and they all decided that the settlements, in other words, every civilian on that across the Green Line was a war crime against the Geneva Conventions, and they had to be removed. So forget the wall. The whole occupation was declared illegal by that decision. Now, everybody went about discrediting, et cetera, but in fact, you get an unanimous decision by the Supreme Court of the world. It made a decision which everybody, you know, only Israel and the United States had denied up until then, but impossible to deny. So that from that moment on, we have a clear situation, despite the attempts to discredit it, by Hillary Clinton and others, by the way, immediately afterwards, Hillary Clinton condemned the world court. So saying that this occupation is illegal and that it's basically an aggression, because it's not in self-defense. Any violent military action, which this obviously is, not in self-defense, is an aggression, the supreme crime. And, by the way, entitles the Palestinians to self-defense and, by the way, entitles them to violate the rules of war, because that's what the general jurisprudence is. When a state's existence is in question, has the right to violate the rules of war. So this is an enormous decision, meaning essentially that the entire occupation is, you know, the supreme crime of aggression and must stop. Of course, it doesn't stop. Of course, Israel has no intention of stopping it. The United States has no intention of stopping it. This is the paradox of international law. We have a very clear decision, and we have this the failure of the big powers to say, well, we don't like that decision, so we're not going to comply with it. Kind of delegitimates all of international law, all of the actions, so-called actions that are taken in the name of it. Because when the game doesn't go according to the way the big powers want it, they just refuse to go along with it.
I guess the international law only exists for the lesser powers, Michael, not for the supreme rulers of the world.
Anatole France, you know, the guy was very famous for saying the law and its majestic equality forbids the rich and the poor from lying under bridges. He also said that the lawyers have written that international law is the law of war, and they have legitimated violence.
Oh, dear me. Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I quote international law all the time, referring to Geneva and the UN Charter and even the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which I guess isn't binding law. But
I don't know about that. I mean, it's pretty binding. I mean, people like to say it's not binding, but it was passed by the General Assembly as an interpretation of the Charter of the United Nations, which is a treaty binding on everybody. I mean, it's quite incredible.
Well,
the disinformation that is supplied about these things. It's a pretty binding declaration, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Well, you have certainly straightened me out on that. I've hesitated. I quote from it, different sections from it. And one time I mentioned it in the context of binding law and was taken to task for it, so I never
did it
again.
Well, it itself is not binding law, but it's a statement of binding. In other words, the General Assembly can't make law. But it's a statement that is meant and agreed to represent the law. It's a very funny thing in international law. It's either by treaty or by custom. The General Assembly of the United Nations can't make law like the Congress of the United States. But when they say, when everybody gets together and say, this is the law, you know, that's a kind of statement that is customary international law. Anyway, it was presented as an interpretation of the Charter of the United Nations, which is binding on all 193 or so countries that have signed it, including Israel, the United States, and Canada.
Oh, very definitely. And you don't have to be a lawyer to read what is in those laws and understand it very, very clearly. So I'll quote different sections of it. But it is shameful that Israel simply ignores it, that the U.S. ignores it. And you wrote about it in your book. Maybe the second half of the program we can get
sure.
to your book.
I will say, though, I have to say this, you know, I'm you know, apart from the politics of it, that international law, while it clearly supports the exclusion of Israel from the 67 borders, it does not necessarily support the one-state solution. There's a problem, of course, that the partition resolution foresaw a Jewish state and an Arab state. And the self-determination rights that the Palestinians have the right to rely upon for their own state also apply to the Jews. So, I hope I'm not disappointing listeners by saying, I'm just calling it as it is, that international law very clearly supports the exclusion by violence, if necessary, of Israel from the territories occupied in 1967, but it does not support, you know, not support as a matter of law, the one-state solution. I mean, it might be a matter of good politics, it might be an inevitability, but it's not of the same level of international law's requirements. And it's the problem of two states, which were foreseen by the partition resolution and by the right to self-determination. So you can take me to task on that, Steve.
Oh, no, I would not take you to task on that. The problem at this stage, Michael, I think you'd agree with me, is that there are 500,000 Jews in settlements in the West Bank. If everybody agreed that we need a two-state solution, at the very least, Palestinians should have the West Bank and Gaza.
Of course, they have to go. Those 500, that's a big war crime. In Canada, it's a crime. It's colonization, and it was specifically enacted because the Germans were colonizing Europe. And in 1949, they enacted the Geneva Convention to say, if you occupy a territory, you cannot colonize it. And you're occupying it only for defensive purposes. You can't settle it.
At the same time, those people are there. They live there. For all practical purposes, it would be very hard to uproot them and move them someplace else. To me, the solution is a one-state solution. I think we're past the two-state solution. You've also got a problem.
Here's the music.
Oh, we hear the music. Let's take another break, and we'll come right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. On with Michael Mandel. Michael, I do know that international law is very clear. It is absolutely prohibited for an occupying country to settle its own people on occupied land. So we have 500 illegal Israeli settlers in the West Bank. Going back 3-4 years ago, when Israel disengaged from Gaza, that had nothing to do with disbanding settlements. That had everything to do with getting really a handful of Israeli settlers. Eight or 10 or 12,000, I forget the exact numbers. And the idea was to expand more of them in the West Bank and get Jews in Gaza away from the line of fire, because Israel planned greater attacks on Gaza, which they did back in 2006, along with the Lebanon War. They attacked Gaza. I think they called it Operation Summer Rain. And then, of course, this last December and January, Operation Cast Lead. I mean, these vicious criminal attacks. Oh, my goodness. I did read one thing in Haaretz this morning, Michael. There's a UN Human Rights Council team headed by Richard Goldstone in Gaza investigating war crimes. And he won't comment any more than a general statement. But the general statement that Haaretz reported today was he was shocked at the level of destruction. Well, my goodness, I haven't been there, and I was shocked right from the beginning. So maybe it took him a little bit too long to be shocked.
Well, it's interesting because Israel, of course, is not cooperating with the investigation. Goldstone is a famous prosecutor from the Yugoslavian tribunal. He's a South African judge. Israel just sort of brazenly said they're not cooperating. They don't regard the U.S. as a legitimate institution because even though they're members of it and bound by it. But this is an old story with the discrediting of the United Nations in Israel.
But
the Gaza war was just atrocious, and I agree with you entirely that the withdrawal from Gaza had nothing to do with autonomy for Palestinians, and it was accompanied by a strengthening of the occupation over the West Bank and Jerusalem, and it was obviously a unilateral disengagement, meaning not part of any peace agreement. And furthermore, they then choked it and bombed it, and before they left, they killed all the leadership. And so it's quite amazing. What's amazing is, this is well understood in Israel, what's amazing is the Western governments, the way they towed the line and repeated the that propaganda that this was a war in self-defense. I mean, you know, obviously it was not a war in self-defense. You know, they killed 1,400 people, I think, with several hundred children after missiles, which, you know, killed maybe 14 people in 10 years, at the same time as Israel had killed about 2,000 people in Gaza in those same years. So there's no grounds for self-defense at all in this, and especially since self-defense, you know, by one nation against another, presumes that the Security Council has had an opportunity to intervene, and of course the Israelis and the Americans prevent the Security Council from intervening. So this is all, you know, upside down, completely the opposite of what's going on. The settlers, I think, are a big problem because, you know, the withdrawal from Gaza involved about 8,000 settlers, and Gaza is not of, religious significance or even strategic significance. When they first conquered it, Eshkol called it a bone stuck in our throats, Gaza. And, still, there was an enormous violence by these vile extremist settlers against the troops that were withdrawing them, and troops who refused to engage in it. One guy who was a Gaza soldier then shot up a bus, a Palestinian bus. Like for that little withdrawal, there was such trauma, and they call it now the crime of Gush Katif, the withdrawal, the crime of Gush Katif, that it was a crime against the settlers. So the notion that they could ever mobilize to withdraw those 500,000 settlers from the West Bank boggles the mind. It absolutely boggles the mind that Israel would do this. Now, they can be forced to do it, you know, and, you know, obviously the United States, as I say, I think really, pulls the strings here in the sense that if the United States was determined to have it done, it would be done.
Oh,
and the fact that it's not done means that the United States is not determined to have it done.
Well, we give Israel billions of dollars every
year. Billions and billions.
And the latest weapons and technology and whatever
they
else.
They test them for the United States. I say we because I'm not an American, but they test them for the United States. I mean, it's strategically very important, Israel. So what I'm trying to say is that it would be, and it's been created this way to be traumatic, but, you know, it could be done. Obviously, you know, the United States has the United States even protects Israel, the Security Council. You know, the United States has more vetoes than any other country, and most of them are about Security Council condemnations of Israel. Often the United States finds itself alone on the Security Council vetoing a resolution condemning Israel or trying to send in peacekeepers or anything into the West Bank that you can imagine. You know, the United States is extremely important. So it's fair to say that whatever is going on in Israel, you know, whatever Obama says, you know, and, you know, I'm not so... I'm waiting to see what happens with this administration. But the fact is, they have the power to do it. If they don't do it, it will be because the political costs are too great to them, or they agree with it. In either case, completely unacceptable reasons for allowing this to go on.
Well, I'm very unequivocal on that, Michael. I think the chance of Obama doing something different than what's gone on up to now is virtually nil. I don't know what his personal views are, but they don't matter. But I would say that there is one other big issue supporting Israel. The Israeli lobby in the U.S. is extremely powerful. And I don't see any way in the world that Obama would buck it. Let's take another break and we'll come
okay.
back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Michael Mandel. Michael, by the way, there is one strategic bit of importance to Gaza, and only in recent years, I think, was it discovered, aside being the frontage on the Mediterranean, there was a discovery of some potentially large gas and maybe oil reserves in the Mediterranean beneath the water's reserves. These belong to the Palestinians, but Israel is co-opting them to develop them for themselves. So that is one reason for being very interested in Gaza, or at least controlling Gaza.
They control the sea in front of Gaza, of course. They don't allow anybody to interfere there, that's for sure. They have a blockade, and even the the sort of withdrawal from Gaza does not mean withdrawal from the seafront of Gaza.
Oh,
yeah, it's horrible what's happening. This business of withdrawing the settlers, of course, you have to distinguish between the militant settlers, and of course the settlers are just there for economic reasons, and these huge developments around Jerusalem. I mean, one way of compensating the Palestinians for the expulsion of 48 would just be to hand over those settlements to them, and I'm sure they could resettle those people. I know people who live in that area. They're beautiful houses there, and but if you give them a beautiful house inside of Israel, they'll take it for sure. And I think they'd be happy to move. So basically, it's a question of money. We have the kind of settlers you have, the Hebron people, those maniacs. They don't amount to 500,000. Nowhere near that.
Oh, indeed.
The 500,000 include people who live in beautiful, developments just around Jerusalem those houses should be handed over to the Palestinians, and they should be resettled. It's a question of money for them, I think.
Well,
in other words, there is a solution if the United States wanted to insist on it.
Well, there are solutions, and of course there are other important issues as well. Israel absolutely wants to expel Palestinians from Jerusalem. The idea of that city being the capital of both states is absolutely untenable for Israel. You've got the refugee problem. International law is very clear on that. Refugees have the right to return, but Israel denies it. Obama is on record saying he opposes the right to return.
Well, the right to return is a very complicated thing, I must say. And as I said, obviously there is the expulsion in 40, from 47 to 49, and then continuing up until even into 1967 was entirely illegal. And Israel was bound to grant nationality to all the Palestinians who lived in its territory when it became a state. And, Israel had a very favorable decision from the partition resolution. It had a small majority in the area that was granted to it. And all those things are absolutely true. It's bound to grant nationality. Nationals have the right to return in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as well. The problem is, however, and certainly Jerusalem is out of the question. Jerusalem is occupied in 1967. The old city of Jerusalem, all the Arab Jerusalem, was occupied in 1967. This is out of the question. I'm talking here about the expulsion that took place in 47, 49, a lot of which was ethnic cleansing, probably most of which was ethnic cleansing. Those people were sinned against enormously, and they live in refugee camps now. But the question of the right of return is a different thing, because some people think of the right of return as a way to a one-state solution. Obviously, if the Palestinians could return to their homelands from which they were expelled, then they would by now constitute a majority of the mandatory Palestine, as they did back then. But that runs up against, as I was saying before, the right to self-determination and the idea of a Jewish and an Arab state. So I think that, we can argue about this, about what's right and wrong and all these things, but I don't think that, from my study of it, the right of return, as an enforceable right of return, has a problem in the sense that it can't contradict the self-determination of the Jews, of the Jewish state that was foreseen there. And so, while on the other hand, the withdrawal from the West Bank, the expulsion from the West Bank, would not harm any legitimate interests recognized by international law of the Jews of Israel, the right of return would, I have to say, that an actual physical right of return. Even though there was, as I said, there was a terrible wrong that was done, it was an ethnic cleansing, it was an expulsion, the compensation would have to be economic compensation. As I say, all those beautiful settlements in the West Bank should be obviously handed over to the Palestinian citizens. But, the question of the right of return, it does run up against that problem. International law is clear as a right, but as a remedy, it's also clear that peoples have the right to self-determination and sovereign states have the right to self-determination.
Well, my preferred solution, whether or not international law supports it, Michael, is for a one-state solution.
Mm.
And Palestine was Palestine for hundreds of years.
Mm.
The Jews were artificially implanted in the region. going back to the Balfour Declaration, 1917.
A small number existed from time immemorial. I mean,
oh, absolutely. Yeah. And they basically got along fine
when the
Arab population was the great majority. They didn't go around slaughtering Jews.
I think the Zionism was a huge problem for the Middle East. There's absolutely no question about it. The Turks were a lot nicer to the Jews than the Europeans.
We will have a discussion. I have had a discussion of Zionism on this program before, and in about 10 days we'll have another one with a new book that is out on the subject.
Mm.
And, it's a very important topic because Zionism is completely different than the way it's portrayed. But can we shift a little bit and talk about your book?
Let's do that.
I think it's an awfully important book, Michael. Again, the title is How America Gets Away with Murder, Illegal Wars, Collateral Damage, and Crimes Against Humanity. And I guess if you've got a lot of themes in the book, I guess if there's one central one, it would be the supreme international crime, and that the U.S., America, commits it all the time. Certainly Israel commits it all the time.
For sure.
The West.
This is a really, this is hence the title of the book. You know, you're saying the title of the book, How America Gets Away with Murder. That comes from the fact that a statement actually made and established the Nuremberg Tribunal by Judge Jackson, who was the American prosecutor at the time, and the establishment of aggressive war, you know, making war not in self-defense, basically, and now it would be not justified by the Security Council, as well as self-defense, which are the only two grounds for doing it. That became the supreme crime. Because it's basically an illegal war, according to Jackson, was simply mass murder. I mean, it's deliberate killing without a lawful excuse. And he said that the banning of war that took place in the 20th century as a means of solving political disputes, that was 1928, the Kellogg-Briand Pact was the one where they renounced war, and the Charter of the United Nations is exactly the same, made war illegal. And therefore, every killing in an illegal war made war not in self-defense illegal. Every killing in an illegal war was murder, and all the other crimes, not only of civilians, but of soldiers. I mean, you know it. The United States knows it. We know it in Canada. Soldiers are human beings, too. We make this distinction between combatants and non-combatants. It's a terrible thing when civilians, non-combatants are killed, but it's a terrible thing when soldiers are killed. I mean, and consequently, the idea was that every aggressive war, every illegal war, not in self-defense, was just mass murder. So the problem was that after Nuremberg, at the insistence of the United States mostly, the international law stopped punishing aggressive war. And every treaty that they put in place to punish international war crimes left out aggressive war, left out the supreme international crime. And that was at the United States' insistence because they committed it all the time. So in essence, the lack of consideration of aggressive war is the main way that America gets away with murder and Israel gets away with murder. So it can say in Gaza, we chose our targets very carefully, et cetera, but it doesn't matter. There's no such thing as collateral damage in an aggressive war. When you've engaged illegally in war, every death is murder. Every death is clearly foreseen. They know it's going to happen. Israelis didn't say, "Oh, we never dreamed that 1,400 people would be killed." No, they said they were justified in doing it because they chose their targets carefully. But you're only justified choosing your targets carefully if you're not the cause of the war in the first place. And that was Jackson's point at Nuremberg, and that was the Nuremberg Tribunal's point. And that's the point, the main point in this world where the United States can go to war on lies against Iraq and kill a million people, against Afghanistan and kill 100,000 people, and basically not face any recourse for it. That's getting away with mass murder. I mean, if you think of the blood on the hands of George Bush compared to the Milosevic and all the others who've been tried for these crimes, I mean, it's just unbelievable that the guy is responsible for killing over a million people in Iraq and 100,000 people in Afghanistan, at least. So that's how America gets away with murder. It's redrafted the law or changed the law so that the supreme crime is no longer a crime at all. It is a crime, but they don't, the Yugoslavia Tribunal, all those tribunals, they didn't have it in their jurisdiction. So what did these guys do, Goldstone and the rest? they went around persecuting America's enemies with phony, corrupt war crimes tribunals to justify America's aggressive war. So in other words, this, my book is basically an indictment of the whole war crime system as a way of letting the big powers get away with mass murder and start aggressive illegal wars.
I think one of the wars that is so important, Michael, is one of the ones you addressed in your book, the Yugoslav War, that the people who even know that the wars against Afghanistan and Iraq constitute war crimes, they think that, well, there was an exception. It was in 1999, and we had this bad guy, Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia, and we had to get rid of him to help the poor people in now we call former Yugoslavia, the people that he was oppressing. Well, whatever he did, it was like comparing a pickpocket to a serial criminal, a serial killer. He was picked. He was targeted way back. I think beginning in the 1980s, but certainly throughout the 1990s. And the idea was that Yugoslavia was too independent a country. It had to be brought into the Western and U.S. orbit. Germany was an arch offender in that war. There's been some great writing on it. Diana Johnstone has been on this program a couple of times, and Edward Herman has written about it. But that war was a war of aggression, and you could say U.S. / NATO, and I think Harold Pinter made some great comments. I forget his exact quotes, but talking about using NATO as a dagger to destroy Yugoslavia, something like that.
Well,
and he went on.
That war was very important because it established the precedent. You know, there's a lot of reasons for that war. Obviously, it was the war also fought over Monica Lewinsky's dress. There was a number of reasons for that war, testing out weapons. But, you know, one guy made a... You know, I think the most convincing explanation of that war is the war against the United Nations system. The Americans were looking for a way to justify going to war without the consent of the United Nations because the Americans lost the confidence in the United Nations. And they also were, you know, obviously losing influence in Europe. So they wanted to – all the Americans can do is – I mean, the American government in the world or what's left with doing is exercising its muscle. We have a collective imperialism, says Samir Amin, and the Americans are the muscle of it. And all the Europeans go along with it because the Americans have the muscle. But the rest of the world doesn't go along with it. The rest of the world doesn't buy it. And the UN system, the charter system, which was written in San Francisco, you know, and invented by the phrase came from Roosevelt, the United Nations, restricts the power of countries, even big powers, to go to war. And the United States didn't like this and has been looking for a way to project its power ever since it lost control of the United Nations, lost its hegemony in the United Nations from decolonization. So it found this humanitarian intervention idea that it could intervene to protect beleaguered people, and found the Kosovo Albanians as the group that the best group to do this with. And it was total BS because it was invented. The whole oppression, the idea of a genocide by the Serbs against the Kosovars was ridiculous. The Kosovars knew that NATO, by the way, is the United States. The United States runs NATO. The chief commander has always been an American general, and from Eisenhower on down. So it provides all the hardware, and the idea of NATO in Afghanistan is basically under the United States command, where they get all these other countries that are dying to get the pleasure of the United States to join into it. So the United States wanted a way to break out of the charter system, and it used NATO at first, and it used this idea of Yugoslavia. When Cheney invaded Iraq, he said, we have the precedent. We have it in Kosovo. And that was a consciously created precedent. You know, we just had in Canada, in Toronto, Bill Clinton and George Bush are now on a speaking tour. And, you know, people think it's ironic these presidents were so different. These presidents are identical. These presidents are just two sides of the same coin, because Clinton projected American power through humanitarian intervention, broke with the United Nations in Kosovo, and George Bush anxiously picked up that precedent with respect to Afghanistan and Iraq. And they both had the same idea, and they get along famously on stage, I'm told. I didn't pay the $1,000 or $2,000 to go to the – we were protesting outside of it. But in fact, This was a very, very important press. It was a terrible tragedy for the people involved. Now we have a narco state in Kosovo, and Serbia is a basket case, and all because the United States wanted to break away from the UN system and project its power into Europe, you know, without the restraint, the democratic restraint. I mean, whatever you say about the Charter of the United Nations, it put restraint on big powers. And when the big powers lost their hegemony, their moral leadership, or their economic leadership in the 1960s with decolonization and the rise of the Third World and the non-allied countries, then the United States was seeking a way to do it. And this is the way it did it. This is the way it did it through Kosovo. It's extremely important, and it's a disaster, the so-called former Yugoslavia now. And this was all very well planned, and very important to use the corrupt international organizations like Goldstone. Like Goldstone, for instance, he's there in Israel now. Don't think he hasn't been talked to. Don't think they know exactly what he's going to say. Don't think this has all been done political. Don't think there's a judge who's just going to call them as he sees them. This guy was the first prosecutor to carry out the American will in Yugoslavia. Very interesting. They said that Milosevic was the mastermind of the 1995 massacres, the 1992 war. When it came to the Dayton Accords, Goldstone did his job. He was ordered not to indict Milosevic so Milosevic could sign the Dayton Accords. He was ordered to indict Karadzic and Mladic, and he did exactly that. And, you know, they met Goldstone. It's very funny because he came to the Yugoslavia tribunal and they said, you know, the CIA is managing your phones. Is that okay with you? Fine, he said. So don't hope for much from him. Whatever has been already been decided.
They told him, Michael. They might have just done it and not said a word to him. Oh, dear, we have to take another break. And we have one more segment, a short segment. Oh, I wish we had a lot more time. We'll take that break, and we'll be right back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to News Hour, on with Michael Mandel. Michael, if I may, I'll just mention a couple of other points in your book, one you mentioned briefly, and then I absolutely wanted to ask you to address an important issue. But you point out that the criminal courts established, whether it's the Yugoslav court or the Rwanda court or the International Criminal Court, it's really corrupted from the start because they don't go after the big stuff, the supreme international crime, and they go after the little ones. That it's okay to prosecute these people, but don't you dare touch anybody from America or the West or Israel or whatever. But the important point I'd love to get your comments on is the Spanish court and the issue of universal jurisdiction. And there is a case that, so far at least, the Spanish court is willing to address taking on Israeli war criminals. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think anything possibly can come from that?
Well, I think the Spanish court, I mean, this is the universal jurisdiction, the idea that in certain crimes against humanity, any court in the world could prosecute them anywhere. And the Spanish court was very active. It issued the indictment for Pinochet back, if you remember, in the mm-hmm. in 1998, I think it was. And of course, Britain and the United States conspired to prevent him from going back to Spain, and they sent him back to Chile, where he lived out his long life with impunity. So in Europe we have a phenomenon of independent magistrates. It's quite interesting that they're not appointed by the government. They rise through the ranks. They're rather independent. In Italy, they're completely independent. That's why they could bring down some corrupt governments. And that's why Berlusconi and all those people want to stop them from being independent. So these people can issue, using this kind of law, can issue their own indictments all over the world for war crimes. In Belgium, they enacted this law that they could do the same thing. Now, it was enacted around the time of the invasion of Yugoslavia, and it was actually done to support this idea that for, you know, to prevent war crimes or arrest war criminals, you could break the United Nations Charter. And that was the idea for it. But then, you know, as time went on, people thought, well, you know, what's a good sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. And you know, if you can charge, you know, the Hutu nuns, then you can charge Sharon, you can charge Bush, and you can charge The various generals in Mofaz in Israel. But in every case in which people have tried to do this, the government, under enormous pressure, has stepped in to shut them down. And in Belgium, they were so upset by this. Donald Rumsfeld said, there's not going to be any more money for NATO if you do this. And he changed the law immediately. They changed the law, said every charge against the United States has to be investigated in the United States. And in Canada, we have a law, a similar kind of law, but, you know, unless you have the government's approval, you can't use it. So when we tried to charge George W. Bush when he came to Canada, we weren't allowed to do it. Now, in Spain, they had this law, and they had these independent magistrates that aren't run by the government who sometimes make different decisions. And, again, they in this case, they started to investigate Israel. But I read just about 2 or 3 weeks ago that the Spanish government was changing the law. That under great pressure, from the United States, from NATO, et cetera, they're going to change the law and not allow the magistrates to prosecute crimes that have no direct connection with Spain. So, the crimes in Yugoslavia had no direct connection with the United States, and they sent Louise Arbour and Richard Goldstone to prosecute them. But that was good when it was, when it wasn't threatening
they're going to break away, Michael. Oh, I do know the Spanish legislature is trying to thwart the whole thing.
They did it in Belgium. And all they do, they prosecute the same Hutu nuns for a massacre that was perpetrated by the United States allies.
Michael, I've got to stop because they're just about to break away. I thank you so much for coming
on. It's a pleasure, Steve.
It was a great discussion, Michael. You have to come back.
I look forward to the next time.
I'm going to shoot you an email right now with a very small request. Thank you, Michael, and join us again tomorrow. Another top guest, another important topic. Please join us.